Okay, so I guess this will be the first lecture about the pure spinner formalism. So there'll be three others. I'll give one tomorrow, and then Thursday there'll be one by Pierre Van Hove, and next Monday by Luca Mazzucato. Okay, so why do we need another formalism for the superstring? So, of course, we already have two. We have RNS and we have Green-Schwarz. And one way to say what those two formalisms are good for is if we think about the states of the superstring. So we have two essential divisions of states. We either have Neuwirth-Schwarz and Ramond, or we have GSO plus and GSO minus. So this is just the open string. Of course, if you do closed superstring, you have the square of this way. So here, for example, is the let's just do open string. So here are the gluons and some of the massive states at integer spin. And here we have the tachyon. And here we have, for example, the massless states of one chirality, and here are massless fermions of another chirality. So the RNS is essentially, although it's called RNS, it really only works nicely in the Neuwirth-Schwarz sector. This is like gluon and tachyon. And this would be like chiral gluino. Of course, this is just the lowest mass stuff. So why do I say that RNS is for this? So if you try to write backgrounds, so this is of course the closed string, but there's an open string version of this. So it's natural to write the actions for closed strings in n equals 1, 1 world sheet superspace. So you can do this very nicely in the Neuwirth-Schwarz sector. So for example, if you want to describe some general background, here X. So I'm not going to go into details. This is just the motivation for. But if you have questions or if I say something wrong, please interrupt me. So this is the auxiliary field, and these are the world sheet fermions, and X is the usual bosonic coordinate. And this is fine if you want to describe GSO plus sector. GSO minus sector, you can always just put in a. So, expanding out in CAP, of course, gives the usual world sheet action, including the dependence on size. But now, an obvious question is, well, how do I describe Ramond, or if I'm doing closed string Ramond, Ramond background? And nobody has with a good answer. I'm not going to prove to you you can't do it, but like, at least I can say what are the problems. So of course, this formalism has world sheet supersymmetry manifest, at least in the Neuwirth-Schwarz sector, but of course space-time supersymmetry is not manifest. So that's, okay, why do you want manifest space-time supersymmetry? I'm not going to discuss that, but certainly you want to be able to describe Ramond-Ramond background. So if you want to describe Ramond-Ramond vertex operators or even Ramond vertex operators, there's some things you have to do that you don't have to do if you stick to the Neuwirth-Schwarz sector. So, for example, you have to introduce spin fields. You have to bosonize if you want to write explicit vertex operators. That automatically implies that you need to put in picture changing because the spin fields have half-integer picture. So it's clear you have to choose some in plus a half and plus some in the minus a half in order to make sense, and that requires picture changing. And picture changing only makes sense if you have on-shell states. So how do you describe backgrounds, which in principle you want to describe any background, and then conformal invariance is going to tell you when it's on-shell. So, okay, so these are some difficulties. with the INS form. So essentially anything you want to do in the Schwartz background, tachyonic or non-tachyonic, it's essentially straightforward to do. But anything you want to do involving Ramond or Ramond-Ramond that are not infinitesimal, so vertex operators you can handle. But as soon as you want to describe backgrounds involving these fields, you're essentially stuck. So there have been some proposals for how to do it, but I don't think any of the proposals work. And so are there any questions about that? So that's, of course, these two sections. Now, Green-Schwarz instead describes these two sectors. And in fact, the pure spinoformism is also going to be better at describing. The pure spinoformism, in some sense, you can think of it as just a covariant quantization of Green-Schwarz. It's not the conventional covariant quantization, but in some sense it does what you would want from a covariant quantization. So, of course, in this formalism, you can also write down background. But here the backgrounds don't depend on a worldsheet superfield. They just depend on an ordinary field in two dimensions. But there are two kinds of... So people like to use capital Z to describe the worldsheet fields in Green-Schwarz. So if you're doing open, you can either have vector index on the bosonic variables, X, or spinner indexes for the thetas. And if you're doing closed superstrings type 2, you can I use the notation theta and theta hat for the left and right moving thetas. And if you're doing type 2a, these have opposite space-time chirality. If you're doing type 2b, they have the same. Yeah? So I'll get there. So just the short answer is everything that's hard to do here in the Ramond sector is hard to do here in the GSO minus sector, and vice versa. So the background here, again, you have a G and B field. Now they depend on just, these are ordinary worldsheet fields, but they depend on capital Z. Okay, sorry for the notation. So this is small z and this is capital Z. And capital M and N can either be vector or spinner, or either of the two types of spinners if you're doing type 2B or type 2A. And then this is the action. Okay, so why do I write dot, dot, dot? So Green-Schwarz would stop here. But if you want to quantize, you find that this action, if you don't put the dot, dot, dot in, is going to give you problems. So I'll tell you what the dot, dot, dot is for the pure spinner case. So in some sense, there's a reason there should be a dot, 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 because at least in RNS, suppose we do the GSO plus sector. So the GSO plus sector, of course, can be described in either case. And on this side, we know that the GSO plus sector, it's not just GMN plus BMN DXM D bar XN. There are other terms coming from the size. So it's natural to expect that there might be other terms here. So what are those other terms we'll get to? Okay, so you might say, well, okay, so RNS does this line and Green-Schwarz does this line, and who cares? Why is one better than the other? Well, usually when we're describing superstring theory, we want all our states to be in the GSO plus sector. So when we do scattering, so let's do one loop. Of course, the external states are GSO plus. So if we're doing external bosonic scattering or Neuber-Schwarz scattering, you would think that you could handle it in both cases. But once you have loops, you know that the GSO plus in the loops does not necessarily have to be in the Neuber-Schwarz sector. So as soon as you have loop amplitude, in order to get the right answer from this formalism, you have to sum over spin structures. So summing over spin structures is just a clever way of getting the GSO minus sector to cancel out. Whereas in this case, of course, there's no need to sum over spin structures. There's nothing to cancel out. So even for Nevers-Schwartz scattering, as soon as you go to loops, this formalism is simpler. So 4.1 loop is much easier to compute here than in RN. Okay, so what has been done with Green-Schwartz up to now is essentially light cone gate. So today, after I go through the motivation, I will discuss the superparticle, in which we will see that in usual Green-Schwartz description, the only way people have been able to the most simple way that people have been able to quantize is in light cone gate. So there have been more complicated versions of quantization of the superparticle using Green-Schwartz, but I won't go into those. I'll just discuss the pure spinner case. But I will show how to do it in light cone gate. So you can also quantize the string in light cone gate for Green-Schwartz. So, of course, this is what Green-Schwartz did in the late 70s and early 80s. And certain computations were possible to do. So, for example, they computed 4.3 and 1 loop. And of course, you can also do RNS in light cone. But the difference between Green-Schwartz or RNS in light cone and bosonic string in light cone is that the light cone gauge string diagram requires interaction point operators. So what that means is that when you draw the light cone diagram, so this would be a one loop with four external states, then if you want to get Lorentz covariant expressions, you need to insert operators at these points where the strings split and join. So this was first shown in RNS language by Mandelstam, and then was also shown to be true in the Green-Schwartz formalism. And this is related to the problem that that Barton already mentioned. When you try to do light cone superstring field theory, you have these contact terms coming from these interaction point operators. So doing this computation in the superstring is much more complicated than bosonic string in light cone gate. And that's essentially what stopped people from doing higher loop or higher point amplitude. Of course, another problem with light cone gauge is that if you want to describe backgrounds which don't allow a light cone gauge, like AdS5 times S5, life becomes much more complicated. Okay, so how is the pure spinner formalism going to be different from Green-Schwartz? So here it turns out we have a kappa symmetry. So today I will explicitly say how this works for the superparticle. So what the kappa symmetry means is that the propagator for the thetas turns out to be, well, you can't define a propagator for the thetas. The kinetic operator is not invertible. So you have to do gauge fixing in order to define propagators for the thetas. And that gauge fixing, at least the way it's usually done, it breaks Lorentz covariance and takes you down to light cone gauge. So in the pure spinner formalism, what's going to encode this kappa symmetry is going to be BRST invariant. And the BRST operator has a very simple form explaining why it has this form is a bit complicated, and I'll say something about that today. But it's constructed from a bosonic ghost. Which satisfies what Cartan would call a pure spinner equation. So I'll say more about this, of course, later. So this is definition of a pure spinner in D equals 10. And d alpha is precisely the constraint you would get if you tried to define the canonical momentum for theta in this formula. So the canonical momentum for theta is not an independent variable. D alpha is the constraint that relates the canonical momentum to theta to the other variable. If this were all first class, then quantization would be straightforward. It has a second class piece, and that essentially is the reason why lambda has to be a constrained bosonic growth. Okay, so that's the essential idea. So, I guess one thing I didn't say is one eventually would like to go beyond superstring theory and try to understand M theory. And of course, in M theory, RNS plays almost no role at all. So there we're really stuck with using this kind of formalism. At least I don't know any proposals for M theory which use Wilkes superfield. And if you use this kind of proposal, then it turns out, so I think Pierre will talk about this on Thursday, there is a natural generalization of this to 11 dimensions, which at least works for the superparticle. It doesn't work for the membrane, but so it seems reasonable to think that there will be some generalization of this which will also be useful in 11 dimensions. Okay, so are there any questions about the motivation? So the motivation is really to understand this sector of the string, which is really the sector of the string theory that most interests. Okay, so there was a question about non-BPS. So I should mention that. So tomorrow I will say something about how to describe the GSO minus sector in this approach. And what you will find is that just like you need spin fields to describe Ramon sector, if you want to describe GSO minus sector here, you also need spin fields and picture changes. So what happens is the GSO minus sector in this formalism will require the thetas to be antiperiodic on the Wilkes. So instead of the psis changing periodicity as you switch from Neuschwitz to Ramon, when you switch GSO plus and GSO minus here, you'll find that the thetas that are being periodic are antiperiodic, and also the lambdas. So again, writing vertex operators for the thetas and lambdas, if they're antiperiodic, are going to require spin fields. And so all of these questions about non-BPS states are difficult to describe. You can describe D-brains, non-BPS D-brains, but if you want to describe the vertex operators associated, for example, with the tachyon, you can do it, but it's a mess. So it's just as messy as the Ramon vertex operator. So an open question is how to describe backgrounds which involve both tachyon and Ramon-Ramon. And I suspect there's no answer to that question. I suspect that there's no formalism that can describe both at the same time. So it may not even make sense to ask about those backgrounds. Okay, somebody can... If you don't have a string theory that can describe the background, how can you say that it's a background of string theory? No, I would say, if I don't have a string theory that I can describe in that background, does it make sense to say that that is a background of string theory? Okay. I would say it's an open question. I would not be surprised. Well, I can't imagine doing it. Yeah. Yes.
So typically you wouldn't have both the one half, but if you have like an unstable D plane and one half, the open string would be a sub minus for the presence of a Ramon and a Ramon program. You've got different situations where you have a Ramon and a Ramon program background, and then there's an unstable brain in the presence.
Okay.
So that's something
So when you say, so I guess the keyword maybe is unstable. That's the point. So it's not. Okay, maybe we'll leave this to discussion. I don't have a good feeling about this, but I think it's a good topic of discussion. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, so before going to the superparticle, let me say a little bit about the history of where this formalism comes from. So of course, it's the work of Green and Schwartz, and also Mandelstam worked in light cone gauge. But this is for light cone Green Schwartz. So this was, I don't know the dates exactly, but then there was a covariant Green Schwartz classical. I guess it was 84, I'm not sure. Okay, then of course there were many attempts to quantize it. So I think that at least, so it's possible that some of the attempts may succeed in the future, but I think the ingredients that at least enter into the pure spinner formalism, there was an approach by Siegel in 86, and his idea was to introduce a conjugate momentum to theta as an independent variable. So instead of just having these actions were just functions of x and theta, he introduced x, theta, and also a conjugate to theta, which I'll call small p. I guess he called pi, but I use pi for something else. And this turns out to be an important ingredient because once you have the canonical momentum to theta, you can write first order actions for theta. So you still have to deal with the fact that you have these constraints here. But in some sense, well, it's a good starting point, and it turns out to work in this pure spin approach. Okay, then there was another approach at understanding kappa symmetry by which I think was 88 or 89. So their idea was, well, I have x and theta. Let me both worldsheet supersymmetrize and spacetime supersymmetrize. So theta turns out to be have a fermionic component and also a bosonic component. So x, of course, does also, but we're used to seeing that. Mm-hmm. Now it turns out if you do this with n equals 1 worldsheet supersymmetry, this lambda is unconstrained. But if you do it with n equals 2, so this was called superembedding. So what it allowed you to do is to understand a relation between kappa symmetry and worldsheet supersymmetry. And what Tonin showed, I think 91 or 92, was if you have n equals 2, so n equals 2 comma 2 or n equals 2 comma 0 if you're doing heterotic worldsheet supersymmetry, it implies that lambda is a pure spinner. And soon after that, Howe showed in 92 that pure spinners are very natural. So Witten had this approach with thinking of these lambdas as twister variables. So probably I should have put that in also. I don't remember when Witten's paper was. Is twister transform. So he had kappa symmetry you know what I mean, right? So Howe understood that if you replace this twister with a pure spinner, then it turns out to be even better. So Witten showed that twisters are useful for understanding superangles, equations of motion. And Howe showed that pure spinners work even better. So some of the equations I'll discuss later, you'll see, were already seen by Howe. And he also discussed supergravity. Okay, so this is one way to get out pure spinners. So around 5 years, the goal was to try to understand the theory in 10 dimensions, but what was done first was understood compactifications of the theory in which not all of the SO91 Lorentz covariance was manifest. So these were these hybrid formalisms. So it was worked out together with Waffe and many other people how to understand the superstring compactified to 4 and 6 dimensions with at least part of the supersymmetry manifest. And then in 2000, it was understood how to do it in 10 dimensions. So this is d equals 10, this was d equals 4, d equals 6. Also d equals 2 was done together with Balilo. Okay, and then this is mostly what I'll talk about today. In 2005, there was a minor addition that helped to regularize the theory. So this was called non-minimal pure spinner. Okay, so that's more or less the history of... So I should mention, of course, there are many papers here discussing covariant Green-Schwarz. But I think up to now, the approach, at least of this paper, seems to be the one that's most relevant. And in fact, Warren has another approach. When was it? 2006, maybe? With Lee? Yeah, okay. So... It doesn't use pure spinners, but I suspect, or Lee Siegel, I suspect it will be related, but it hasn't yet been related. So it's a different approach to covariance quantization of the superstring. It hasn't gone as far as the pure spinner formalism, but okay, it's not clear how far they can go. Okay, so that's essentially motivation and history. So are there any questions? Okay, so now I'll start with the superparticle. So today I will concentrate on the superparticle, which of course has all of the problems and all of the solutions that the pure spinner formalism will. So of course, if it works for the superparticle, it's not obvious it will work for the string, but if it doesn't work for the superparticle, it's obvious it's not going to work for the string. Okay, so the starting point is the Brink-Schwarz superparticle. Which, as I mentioned, is relatively straightforward to quantize in light cone gauge, but it's not at all straightforward how to quantize it covariantly. So the action is very simple. So pi m will be defined as, well, in this case, it's just x dot. Okay, so one thing I will either apologize or warn you, I's will be absent from all formulas. So if you want, if you force me to, I can put in I's. So the only thing that will be funny will be hermeticity properties. But I find it much easier to work without the eyes. Okay, so let me give you the notation. So, of course, m is 0 to 9. Alpha is 1 to 16. So this is a chiral 10-dimensional spinner. And gamma, they're symmetric. And they're related to the usual 10 dimensional. So in 10 dimensions, of course, you have 32 component spinners. The vial component is 16, the antiviral is 16. So that means in the vial representation, you can think of the gamma matrices. Having these off-diagonal square components, so these are 16 by 16 matrices. And the usual gamma matrix relation for capital gamma implies that the small gamma satisfy these relations. So if I symmetrize in M and N, this gives you 2, 8, and N, alpha gamma. And there's a nice relation in 10 dimensions, which will be useful to know, which is that if you contract the vector indices and symmetrize in 3 spinner indices, this is 0. Okay, so that's the notation. So this turns out to be the symmetric version, a supersymmetric version of X dot, in the sense that pi m is invariant under supersymmetry transformation. So delta theta is just epsilon alpha. It's just global spacetime supersymmetry. And delta xm is equal to minus. So epsilon is a spinner of the same chirality as theta. So these indices obviously are up and gamma matrix is down. And this leaves pi m invariant. And e is also invariant. Okay, so this, of course, I can write in first-order form as... Sorry, this detail. Where I have the p-squared constraint. So this is the action I want to quantize. And the first thing to notice is that the canonical momentum to theta, because you have a theta dot here, is just going to be I guess there's a minus sign because I have to pull it through. So this is going to be equal to minus 1/2 p slash theta. So that means there's a constraint. The Dirac constraint is that, well, this is supposed to be equal to 0. Okay, so this constraint, it's easy to show using the standard anti-commutation relations for small p and theta. You find that d alpha with d beta, instead of being 0 because of this anti-commutator, gives you just pm. And now, because p squared equals 0, you can show that half of these are first class and half are second class. So, for example, if you choose p to be just in the plus direction, the only non-zero component, it's easy to see that gamma plus of d is first class and gamma minus of d is second class. Okay, so we have... Okay, so now we can quantize by using the to quantize we have to first of all we have to gauge fix the first class part of the constraint. So it's easy to see that d alpha has a first and second class piece, but the first class piece can be understood as just writing p slash d. So these are the first class. Why? Because if I anti-commute this with itself, you always get a factor of p squared out. So you know that when p squared equals 0, these all anti-commute with itself. And of course, because p squared equals 0, there's only 8 of these 16 components are independent. Okay, so we can use these to gauge fix A to the thetas away. So we do that by just looking what are the transformations generated by these operators. So you find that delta theta alpha is going to be equal to P slash kappa. So now kappa is going to be, let me write it out in indices, is a spinner with the opposite chirality from theta. So this is now not space-time supersymmetry, this is kappa symmetry. So for the superparticle, this was first found by Siegel. And it's easy to show that when you do this transformation on this term here, it's going to be proportional to P slash. So this will give you something like theta dot P slash kappa, and then with a gamma matrix there, and then that will give you theta dot kappa P squared, which will be canceled by varying E. So this action is invariant under this for arbitrary kappa. So kappa is a local parameter, it's not global. So we can use this to gauge fix, for example, gamma plus theta. Okay, so a 16 component spinner in 10 dimensions, if you reduce it to SO, in terms of SO8 components, it splits into an SO8 chiral spinner, which I'll use the notation A. And also, so my SO8 notation will be A and A dot for chiral and anti-chiral spinner, and J will be an SO8 vector. Okay, so if we use these kappa symmetries to gauge fix away this half of the thetas, then we're left with an action which is just first order in the thetas, and then we can quantize. Okay, so what happens is only gamma, so theta A dot is the other eight components. So this is all that's left of the theta P slash theta dot term. And now we can just define S A dot is equal to square root of P plus theta A dot. So this just becomes you'd want to put a minus sign here, but I guess normally one considers P plus positive, but I I wouldn't be surprised if, so because P plus equals zero is a sick, so you can't continuously go from positive to negative, I wouldn't be surprised if there were two different conventions for the two different cases. I would just put a minus sign everywhere. Okay, I guess I didn't say, but of course I should have said, this gauge fixing is only possible if P plus is non-zero. Okay, so now with this action, of course, we have the usual Clifford algebra. So this is just delta A dot B dot. And now if these were vector indices, it would be precisely the same as gamma matrices. If you're having SOH, you have triality. So essentially vectors and spinners essentially transform in similar ways. So you can solve this constraint, well, you can quantize this type of algebra in the same way as you do if they were vectors. So what do you do? So this implies that the physical state, so if this was a vector index, what you would have is you would have Dirac spinners, so you would have spinners of one chirality and spinners of vial and antivial spinners. Because this is a spinner index, what you get is you get vector and chiral spinners. And so this is supposed to be the wave function. So this is a function of x. And if you act on this with SA dot, it takes you into this with a Pauli matrix. So remember, SOH you can raise and lower indices as you like. So this would be how the S acts on a vector wave function and how it acts on a vial spinner. Obviously, it acts like. And it's easy to see with this definition up to some factors of 2, this is going to give you this type of algebra. Okay, so of course this constraint here is just going to tell you that these have to satisfy box psi equals zero. So you have 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic degrees of freedom, massless. These are the degrees of freedom in light cone gauge of d equals 10 superangles. So we've shown in light cone gauge that the Brink-Schwarz superparticle describes a free super-Yang-Mills multiple. Like super Maxwell or super-Yang-Mills, it's free, it doesn't matter. Okay, is there any questions? Okay, that's fine, but now we want to do things covariantly. So the first thing to answer is, how do you describe super-Yang-Mills in a covariant way? So, of course, okay, so we're going to solve this problem in 2 steps. So the first step is to see what we want to get out. And then we're going to show how to get the solution we want out by modifying the Brink-Schwarz action, or by understanding the gauge fix in a covariant way, if you want to say it that way. Okay, so, of course, covariant super-Yang-Mills is described by a gluon and a gluino. And these are supposed to be on-shell. So we're not going to try to describe off-shell super-Yang-Mills in covariant. We're just going to try to describe on-shell. So of course, the field strength should satisfy to linearized level. You just want. Okay, so those are the fields we want to describe. So of course, we know how to do it in components. So we've just done it in components. Now we want to do it in superspace. So why do we want to do it in superspace? Because obviously our superparticle action is going to be give me wave functions which are functions of x and theta. So we want to combine these component fields into a superfield. Okay, so it's known how to do that. I think it was first done by Warren. Also, it's of course in the paper I already mentioned of Witten. So the way to do that is you start with the usual fermionic supersymmetry derivatives. So just like you do in Wessenbagger, you can do in 10 dimensions. So dm is, of course, ddxm. And now we're going to covariantize this. So we're going to extend this by including a connection. In the same way, of course, as we do for ddxm, which sometimes I'll also write just as dm. So this is go to del m. But now, unlike ordinary Yang-Mills, this is going to be a superfield also. So this is the natural thing to do. And now suppose one considers the usual anti-commutator of two supersymmetric derivatives. Well, this is usually just going to give you up to factors of I. This is just going to give you gamma. So this is the usual supersymmetry algebra. And now we're going to covariantize that. Now that turns out to put constraints on these superfields. Because you see, del alpha depends on A alpha, and del M depends on AM. So you'll get the relation between A alpha and AM. Okay, so what is that relation? So if there are questions or I'm unclear or anything, please interrupt me. Oh, sorry. So this is just dm. So, of course, everything I'm doing here is to linearized level, but there's no problem in doing the nonlinear level. So for the non-abelian case. Okay, so del alpha. This implies the following conditions on the superfield. So it tells you that gamma m. So first of all, it tells you that to linearized level, it's del d alpha of a beta plus d beta of a alpha is equal gamma m. So to nonlinear level, there's another term which is a alpha a beta. So this has, this is of course symmetric in alpha and beta. In 10 dimensions, something symmetric, a bi-spin which is symmetric, can either be a one form or a five form. Okay, the three form turns out to be anti-symmetric in alpha and beta. So this equation obviously tells you that the one form of d alpha a beta is just proportional to am. So I think it's a factor of 10 or something like that. And the 5 form this is 0. Okay, so these are the superfield equations which follow from if you impose this condition on the covariant derivative. Okay, now of course these covariant derivatives are defined up to a gauge transformation, just as ordinary AM is defined up to a gauge transformation. So the gauge transformation is delta A alpha is equal to del alpha of omega, and delta AM is equal to dm or del m of the same omega. Okay, it's easy to see that doing this gauge transformation is not going to change this algebra. Okay, so now one can ask, okay, these equations up to these gauge transformations imply what conditions for the components in the superfield? Okay, so A alpha So first of all, this equation obviously tells you that if you know A alpha, you know AM. Okay, so we only need to solve the condition for A alpha. So the equation for A alpha comes just from this equation here. This doesn't contain any information. It just tells you what AM is. Okay, now the lowest components of A alpha you can obviously gauge to zero using this gauge transformation. So what you find is that the first component that you cannot gauge to zero is a vector field. Then at order theta, you find, at order theta squared, you find the next term that cannot be gauged to zero is a spinner field. And it turns out all the other components, so theta cubed, is going to be related to the derivative of A. Theta fourth will be the derivative of chi. Theta fifth will be two derivatives on A. It can all be written in terms of A and chi. And furthermore, this equation here implies that FMN, so to linearized order, implies this equation. And if you work it out to higher order, it just gives you the full, the usual DM. So it gives you the usual non-abelian superangles equations of motion. Okay? And these gauge transformations just tell you that AM is defined up to a gauge transformation. So this is A alpha. You find AM is just, it starts out as the ordinary gauge field. At order theta, you get the Gluino. And then at higher order, you get derivatives of A, etc. Okay, so this is the covariant way in superspace to describe superangle. Are there any questions? I have gauge fixed everything except for AM. Now, it can also describe field strength superfield. So these are the gauge superfield. So the field strength superfield you define in exactly the way you would in ordinary Yang-Mills. So for example, you define the commutator of del alpha with del m. It turns out it can be written in terms of a superfield which starts with the Gluino. And of course, this is a superfield which starts with the usual field. So these field strength superfields will also play a role. Okay, so that's covariant superangle. Now one comment I will make, which I won't go into, but it's an interesting comment to make, is if I go back to the original Brink-Schwarz action and I ask, well, how do I write it in an electromagnetic background, or if you like, super Maxwell background? So I have my original action, and suppose I have some charge, and I want to couple to super Yang-Mills. Well, the natural action to write down is, coupling term to write down, one can easily show this term is gauge invariant, just because when you gauge transform these superfields according to these gauge transformations, it's easy to say that this changes just by a total derivative. It's obviously space-time supersymmetric because theta dot and pi m are space-time supersymmetric. Now, the next thing you want to ask is if this coupling preserves kappa symmetry. And you find that it only preserves kappa symmetry when A alpha and AM satisfy these equations. So it's something new from, if you were trying to do just the ordinary particle in electromagnetic background, you would never derive Maxwell's equations from some consistency condition of the particle action. Oh. Okay, so then he just explained why. Okay, so fine. So because this, of course, has spin 1 in it, because it's super Yang-Mills, then somehow it knows that this has to be on shell. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so now the next step is, it will look like we're going in some direction that is completely unrelated, but it will turn out to be useful. So we want to describe a first quantized description of a gauge theory. And as far as I know, there's only one example that works nicely. Maybe Warren knows other examples. But certainly the example that works the nicest is Chern-Simon. So let me leave this in. So let me change gears before doing quantization of this superparticle and do Chern-Simons, because it will have many of the ingredients that we'll need for this. So it's a little bit strange, but of course, if you just quantize the ordinary particle, you get a scalar. It doesn't have any gauge symmetries. So things look a little bit different when you want to quantize a system which is supposed to describe a gauge theory. So I think this was first done by Witten. Although, I mean, of course he does the string and not the particle, but it's essentially the same thing. So suppose we start with the usual massless particle action. Well, we introduce an extra constraint. So the extra constraint is going to be, so mu here is 1 to 3. And we want to quantize this action here. So what I want to argue is that this action describes Chern-Simon. And then, of course, the next thing to do is to show that if I do all the steps that I do here for Chern-Simons can then be, I can do something similar for the superparticle, and I'll get super Yang-Mills. Okay, so to quantize this, I'm going to use BRST gauge fixing. So I'm going to gauge fix. I, of course, have, these are first class constraints. This is just P mu. So these are just, L mu is just the Lagrange multiplier, if you like. It imposes, I mean, it's just the usual Dirac formula when you have constraints. So you multiply the Lagrange multiplier by the constraint. So I have the usual world line reparameterizations of E, and I have these extra ones. You can. So I will treat that as a gauge for gauge. So there's an extra gauge symmetry which will do that shift. Okay, so I'm going to fix E equals 1, and I'm going to fix L mu equals 0. And that, of course, will generate Fadeev Popov Ghost. I called them C. So these are all fermion equivalents. And there's an additional gauge invariance, which is I can shift L by P and get rid of E. So let me also gauge fix that. So I'll also have a... that's a bosonic... Let me write that one I want to say, and then I'll get there. So I claim this is the BRST symmetry that I want to get. So this symmetry is, of course, these are the usual terms that I would get from the constraints from gauge fixing L and E. But then you can see that there's a ghost for ghost, which comes that if I shift C by P mu, then it can be compensated by shifting C, and that's what this does. So this beta and gamma, I want to think of as the ghost for ghost that comes from the additional gauge invariance from the C. Okay, now this, of course, you can do a similarity transformation, and it just becomes Q equals C mu, capital C mu, minus gamma B. So the similarity transformation is just, I do R. It's just going to get rid of this term. So it's going to be C B mu, B mu, and this is going to be E to the minus R. That's right. Should work. Okay, and this is also going to take B. So if I think of defining the B ghost from QB equals B squared, then once I've written it in this form, the B ghost, let me call this Q tilde. B tilde is going to be B plus E mu. So it's easy to see the Q tilde with B tilde also gives you the P squared. Okay, so because of this extra term here, so I'm doing this, it may look like I'm doing overly complicated. I could have just removed this from the beginning, and then I would just be left with this. The reason why I left this term in, is because there's going to be something similar that happens for the superparticle. So this extra term in Q tilde means that these two fields essentially decouple from the cohomology. So I could have, this is the usual topological term, so this means I could have computed the cohomology just using C mu, P mu. So my physical states will be just functions of C mu and X. And they will have to satisfy Q phi equals zero and delta phi. So I'm going to do the usual BRST quantization. Okay, so of course these are fermionic fields, so I can expand in powers of C. So let me just expand in components. So this is the expansion in C. I only have up to C cubed because they're fermionic and I have three of them. And now what I claim is that these equations and gauge invariances, if you work it out, you find that it implies that A mu satisfies that D mu A nu equals zero. And it also implies D mu lambda equals zero. And finally, it implies d rho a star rho equals zero. So this is implied by q phi equals zero. And the gauge transformation implies that delta a mu equals d mu of some lambda, the delta of A star mu is equal to d rho of some lambda mu rho. And finally, it implies that delta lambda star is equal to d rho of some lambda rho. Okay, so these are the equations of motion and gauge invariances associated with the cohomology. And it's easy to see that A describes Chern-Simons. So to linearize level, this is just the equation of motion from Chern-Simons. This is associated with the anti-field Chern-Simons. And finally, lambda and lambda star are associated to the ghost and anti-ghost associated to the gauge invariance of Chern-Simons. So we can make this clearer by writing down the full... Let me do it over here so I don't have to. Suppose we write down this action, the same action that Barton wrote down, but of course, I'm just doing naive multiplication. So if you want to include the cubic term, then you have to think of it as some non-abelian action. These phis are fermionic and their indices are contracted with the structure constant. And then this action, the norm here is defined such that C1, C2, C3 equals 1. And now if I plug this phi in here into this action, you get just the Chern-Simons action, including the anti-field contribution. So you get C cubed x. So the usual thing. Okay, I'll write it down. Plus the anti-field part. So the anti-field part is okay, so we see that covariant quantization of this action using BRST techniques leads directly to not only the linearized Chern-Simons, but it's easy to get the full nonlinear by including the phi cubed term in the action. Okay, so this is the relation of the first quantized description with the action that Barton described to me. Yeah, okay, so that's a... So when you're doing the particle, you don't have Chan-Peyton factor. So that's a leap. I agree. So if you really quantize this system, you'd really only get this term. But it's clear that how to generalize it once you get that term. Wouldn't work. Would give nonsense. It would give nothing that I would recognize. I could ask you, what's wrong with the superparticle action if I try to do it in other than 10 dimensions? It gives something. I don't know what. But this is nicer. Okay. I can't say why this works, but it does. Okay. So we're going to try to imitate how it works. Well, it's essentially Witten simplified. Okay. It's just a particle. Warren told me about it. I don't know where Warren... Warren probably just saw Witten's paper and simplified it. Okay. This one? He wrote it for the full string. He didn't write this action because he did it for the string. He did the topological string associated with this. If you do it for... Yeah, when you do it for the topological string, so Q becomes... This thing here becomes psi mu dx mu. So the topological string you can always, well, this topological string you can get from gauge fixing this. I don't know if he discussed it, but there have been so many papers, I'm sure somebody discussed it. Okay, so are there any questions about this? So we're going to try to imitate this for the superparticle. Okay, the first thing I need to say is what's a pure spinner? So that won't take long, that is, I don't have too long. So Cartan, we find a pure spinner. So indeed, even dimensions. It turns out that this matrix here is always a symmetric tensor. So that means it makes sense to ask the question, suppose I have a spinner, a bosonic spinner, and I multiply it by another bosonic spinner, the same bosonic spinner, but these indices obviously are symmetric in alpha and beta, and I can ask if this is proportional to if it's proportional to this tensor or not. If it's proportional to this, he called it a pure spinner. He said it's in French. I don't know the translation. Okay, so this you could define in any even dimension. It turns out projective pure spinner it parameterizes the space S. So projective just means you ignore the scale part. It parameterizes space SOD over U D over 2. It's easy to prove this from here. You just choose a direction. So you choose a lambda which satisfies this. And then you ask what subgroup of SOD does it preserve. So to prove this, in d dimensions, you can always, if d is even, you can always break your gamma matrices up into complex combinations. I'm sorry? This here? This is lambda, sorry. So you can always, so in d dimensions, lambda in general will have d over 2 of these plus or minus signs, right? And now suppose I choose them all to be plus. It's easy to show that that's a pure spinner. That satisfies this. And now one can ask, okay, what subgroup of SOD preserves this? And it's easy to see that it's UD over 2. So that's one way to show that that's how it's going. Okay, so now we're in 10 dimensions. So in 10 dimensions, this is SO10 over U5. So I'm going to have to erase this. This I don't need. Proportional. So there's a constant here, obviously, because if you just contract both sides with gamma m, it's something like 1 over d over 2 factorial or something like that. Okay, so in 10 dimensions, you have SO10 over U5. And then you have the scale factor. So this is a 10-dimensional complex space. It says 45 divided by 25. You can easily say show it's complex. So this is means you have 11 independent complex parameters. And of course, this condition here tells you lambda gamma m lambda is equal to 0. So in 10 dimensions, as I already mentioned, the only symmetric bispinors are a 1 form and a 5 form. The 5 form is non-zero, but since the 5 form is the only component, the 1 form must be 0. So that's in 10 dimensions. Okay, so there's one feature I don't think I'll get to today. So let me... Tomorrow I will show you how to parameterize solutions of this. I won't do that yet. Okay, so now we want to go to the superparticle and essentially reproduce this type of structure. Okay, so the same starting point as Brink-Schwarz. Now, the first step is easy and is inspired by things that Warren looked at in the past, which is to insert a first-order term for the thetas with some independent object p alpha. Now, of course, if you do that, you want it to be equivalent to this. You need to put in a Lagrange multiplier, which enforces that d alpha is 0. So you need to put in this term, where d alpha is the same as we saw before the green curve. So obviously, if you solve the equation of motion for f alpha, which is just d alpha equals 0, then you can replace this term by this. Okay. I haven't done anything yet. Now we want to quantize it. Now this naively looks like the thing above, but of course there's a crucial difference, which is that d alpha has a first and second class piece. So we have to be more clever. Now, I'm going to tell you what the answer is, and then probably tomorrow, the first thing I'll do is I'll justify how you get there. So this is a bosonic ghost. And of course, this is also bosonic. So the claim is that after gauge fixing, this action will reduce to that, in the same sense that action reduced to here. So actually, after canceling out, there'll be an intermediate step where I have these type of fields in the game. And Q, which will come from the gauge fixing, will just be lambda alpha dl. And just as before, there'll be actually an additional term, which so this is actually after doing a similarity transformation, precisely as we did. Okay, so let me explain why this, how you show that this gives the right answer. So in exactly the same way as I did for Chern-Simons. So this is a step which we justify. When you do this justification, you will see that lambda is a pure spin. So now what I want to show is that now my phi will be a function of x and theta and lambda. So again, it doesn't depend on w for the same reason in Chern-Simons it didn't depend on b mu. That's the momentum conjugate to lambda. So the difference is that lambda here is bosonic. So when I expand, the expansion goes on forever. But now I can again impose Q phi equals 0. And delta phi is Q of omega. And this implies that... Now here it's interesting because Q is constructed using this pure spinner. So when I take Q on phi, I will get a term which is lambda alpha. So the first term is obvious. It's lambda alpha d alpha lambda. So this being 0 is going to tell me d alpha lambda equals 0. The second term tells me that... So this in general has a one form and a five form part. But you see, because lambda gamma lambda equals 0, this being 0 only implies that the five form part is 0. So Q phi equals 0 gives me this equation for A, which is, of course, precisely what we wanted from superheating those equations of motion. And the gauge invariances here, of course, imply if you write this as Q of something, you'll find that delta A alpha is just d alpha omega. And you get further gauge transformations for these fields. Okay, so we see that A alpha satisfies the same equations of motion in gauge invariance as superheating Mills. And in fact, one can go even further and show that A star and lambda star, this satisfies the correct equations of motion for the antifields for superheating Mills. So you can expand, just as I expanded before A alpha in... It turns out that the antifields, they start, you start with the antifield for the gluino, and then there's a term at theta fourth, which is the antifield for the gluon. So if you force me, I can write out the components, but a bit of a mess. Okay, so it turns out that the cohomology of this phi describes precisely, this is the Yang-Mills ghost. So because of this equation here for lambda, only the constant component survives. And that's, of course, the Yang-Mills ghost. A alpha describes the super Yang-Mills fields. A star turns out to describe the super Yang-Mills antifields. Lambda star, it turns out, has only one physical component, one component in the cohomology, which is so it has kind of a funny form. So the only component of lambda star in the cohomology has five thetas. And because it appears at cubic ghost number, it has three lambdas. And these are combined into some scalar. This turns out to be associated with the anti-ghost for superangle. And all the terms with higher amounts of lambdas are not in the cohomology. Okay, it's not trivial to show, but it's straightforward. So what you find is that if you quantize this action and you follow the same procedure as we did for Chern-Simon, you find it the same action here. After you integrate out the auxiliary fields, you get, so this is dm. Okay, plus the usual interactions. super Yang Mills, plus you get the anti-fields also. So the anti-fields are... Okay, now... So this... So it gives you the usual Yang-Mills action, including the anti-field. Now, the one thing I haven't told you is, how did you find this norm? Okay, so this is going to be also something I will postpone until tomorrow. So here the norm was defined. You had fermionic ghosts, so it was easy to find this norm. And now in this case, if I can do it, no. Yeah. In this case, naively, you would have to integrate over the lambdas. We have 11 of them. We have to integrate over the thetas, 16 of them. And, of course, over the x's, we have 10. So naively, you would define f of x theta lambda as this integral here. Now, if f is just a polynomial in lambda, this integral obviously diverges because it has 11 lambdas. Now, what we're going to find is that the correct answer is given by this, so I'll tell you. So this plays the analog of the C1, C2, C3. So how do you get from here to here? Well, you have to regularize. So naively, if you had a function which only depended on five thetas, like here, you would get a factor of 0 to the 11th, because every theta that's not in here would give you a 0. So in some sense, this answer here is going to give you e10x. You have infinity to 11th coming from the lambdas, and you have a 0 to the 11th. Coming from the thetas, which are not in this expression. So what we have to show is that there's a regularization procedure in which you can make sense out of this 0 over 0 to the 11. So that involves these non-minimal fields. So what we're going to have to do is introduce a new set of variables. So I'll just give you a bosonic and fermionic set in such a way that when we integrate, so that you modify the BRST operator to be lambda alpha V alpha plus. Where W bar is the conjugate. This and S alpha is the conjugate. So you introduce some quartet, and you do it in such a way that these states will decouple from the cohomology. But now the functional integration, instead of being just an integration over x's and thetas, will now give you I guess I'm almost, if I can have 5 minutes, I can actually do this now. I guess I want to build enough. So maybe I'll take 5 minutes and just tell you what this n is. So what we're going to do in order to regularize this 0 over 0... Okay, so we're going to introduce new variables. So these are the so-called non-minimal variables. So these were not in the original formulation, but they're just used to do the regularization. So we're going to modify the BRST operator by hand. So we add this term to the BRST operator. which naively tells you that anything depending on these non-minimal variables decouples from the cohomology. Now, if I want lambda to be the complex conjugate of lambda bar, I better have that this is also a pure spinner. So, and in order to be consistent, you also need to impose that R, if you take the gamma matrix with lambda bar, is zero, just because if I commute Q with this constraint, it will give you this one. Okay, so these are the conditions. That means that lambda bar has 11 independent components and also R. And so this constraint implies that instead of having 16 independent R's, you only have 11. So here I need to also integrate over R. Sorry, I forgot to do that. Okay, so now I'm going to choose N in a clever way. So N is going to be defined to be the exponential of something which is BRC trivial. So in fact, I'm going to put a constant here. So rho is just a constant, which I can take to be as small as I want, but not zero. Now, if I write this out, this gives me e to the minus rho times lambda bar. I think with a minus sign, r. So you see the first term here comes from commuting the q with the theta, because of this term. The second term comes from commuting the q with the lambda bar, which gives this term. So now n, you see, has a cutoff, has a Gaussian cutoff for the lambdas. So this is equal to e to the minus. So as long as f has no lambda bar or r dependence, it's trivial to now integrate over lambda bar and r. So this is just some Gaussian dependence on lambda bar. And this term here, what it does is if f has no r dependence, in order to soak up the 11 r's I need here, the exponential has to contribute 11 r's and 11 thetas. So what happens is the 11 thetas soak up 11 of these 16 thetas, and you're just left with the 5 thetas left over. So this gives you, after doing the integration, you just get d10x d5 theta e d lambda cubed times f. Where the indices here, so this obviously has spinner indices and this does too, they're contracted in precisely the same way that they're contracted here. So with this definition, with this inclusion of these non-minimal fields, now you can regularize the expression and get something which matches with this desired normalization. So this is the desired normalization because this object here was precisely the state at ghost number 3 in lambda star. So it's the unique state in the cohomology at ghost number 3, which of course in bosonic string theory is just CDC d squared C, and Chern-Simons is C1, C2, C3. So this is the natural answer. And in fact, if you use this and compute phi q phi, as I did above, you just get the superangular of that. So there is a connection with, so this is for the particle. So obviously the next thing is to try to generalize this to the string and try to construct a cubic open string field theory action off of it. So there are some subtleties that probably tomorrow, at the end of tomorrow, I will talk about. But for the superparticle, it's completely straightforward. Okay, so that's it.